Good evening. Why, I wonder, did you turn on your radio tonight to listen to this programme? Let's assume it was because you positively enjoy the prospect of a provocative debate, which we modestly see ourselves in the business of delivering. So why exactly does that appeal to you? Does your pleasure come from some innate level of intelligence? Is it because your mother or father enjoyed lively conversation, introduced you to it? Maybe you've always had an aggressive streak and liked a good argument, but did it better with your mind than with your fists. Maybe you found you could pull boys or girls by clever talk rather than fancy footwork. And this bit of your personality that feels so much a part of you, would it have been the same if you had been given away at birth to a family of sheep herders on the Greek mainland, or even to that slightly strange lot who lived down the road at number 43? Welcome to the first of a new series of Nightwave's Undercurrents, which today goes boldly where many have fallen before, into the nature versus nurture debate. This week sees the publication of a large book on the subject. Its author is Steven Pinker, best known for his language instinct, which argued that the ability to learn language is hardwired into human beings. His new book, The Blank Slate, subtitled The Modern Denial of Human Nature, goes a good deal further, arguing that far from human beings being blank slates, they arrive extremely heavily scribbled upon, both in terms of genetic heritage and evolutionary characteristics. This, in turn, has an impact on the way we must try and forge a just society, built on incorporating innate difference rather than necessarily pursuing philosophic equality. His critics may smell a form of biological determinism and worry that such science has profound and disturbing implications. Well, sitting in the Nightwave studio is Steven Pinker. Next to him is the philosopher John Gray, who also has a book out on this very subject. And opposite is the sociologist Hilary Rose, no stranger to this debate. And I fervently hope we're also going to be joined by Oliver James, who has also written on this and is on his way as we speak. At this moment, I think I can safely say that nothing about the next 45 minutes is predetermined, though it is my sincere hope that a form of social justice may prevail. Stephen Pinker, can I begin with you? Not everyone will have read your book, and therefore I think it would be really helpful if you could sketch out what it is you're actually saying. Let's start with that big area of innate humanity. What do you see as innate in human nature? What do you want to claim for yourself there?
Yes. Well, the book starts off from common sense. That is, many parents have said to me, how can anyone who's had more than one child really believe that children are blank slates? How can anyone who has been in a relationship with a member of the opposite sex believe that? How can anyone who's noticed that children learn language but house pets don't really believe that the entire structure of the mind seeps into it from the environment? Now, the person who believes that it's all in the genes is a figment of people's imagination. The so-called genetic determinist is a person that I've never met. And I say from the outset that learning and culture are essential to all aspects of human experience. The question is, why has the contribution of our genetic endowment been seen as so dangerous? You alluded to the fear that acknowledging human nature will lead to dire consequences. There have certainly been terrible, horrific misapplications of racial doctrines in the 20th century, although there have been equally horrific misapplications of the notion that humans have no nature and therefore an enlightened state should take over all aspects of child rearing and social interaction, authoritarian dictatorships. The point of the book is not to argue that heredity is important. It's really to diagnose why it's been so hard even to study this question because of the terror that intellectuals have of the idea that any part of our personality and intellect can be explained by genes and evolution.
Well, let's push that a bit more into the political sphere. I suppose that the fear here is that if you write too much on the slate, so you're defining things by difference rather than possible equality, that the system that you bring in to implement it is quite likely to not want to bother because they don't need to shift the status quo, that the need for social justice is somehow reduced by that.
Yes, that's one of the four fears that I identify in the book. If people are innately saddled with fatal flaws, if people have a tendency towards prejudice to people outside the group, or towards selfishness, or towards a preference to the family to strangers, does that mean that there's no point in improving society because people will just louse it up no matter what you do? I argue that that's a non sequitur. we know that there can be social progress because there has been social progress. We don't have slavery in the West anymore. We enjoy rates of violent crime that are orders of magnitude lower than were common even a couple of hundred years ago, let alone in hunter-gatherer societies. We've seen the position of women change radically in our own generation. My mother's opportunities were far more constrained than women's opportunities.
But that's partly because we slightly rebelled against the notion of difference and went for equality as women. I mean, we pushed against the traces to get there.
Well, what was pushed for was equality of opportunity, that no one should be prejudged based on any stereotype of gender, a noble principle that is not under threat by any conceivable finding of science. And so there's no incompatibility, I argue, between even a study of the biological basis of sex differences and the ideals of feminism as originally conceived as a movement toward equity.
Okay, John Gray, you've read Stephen's book. I didn't manage to tease a lot out of him as exactly what he wants to pull into his innate camp. How far do you agree with him, and how far do you want to step back or go further?
I agree to a very considerable extent with Stephen's argument that a great deal that has been claimed for culture or society is in fact hardwired in human beings, that human beings are animals, as Darwin discovered, and that we're hardwired in a whole variety of ways. But that doesn't necessarily, it seems to me, support the kind of horrific repressions that many people have accused biological explanations of. After all, one of the things it shows is that there is a common human nature, that we are all the same animal, we have common human needs, we have common human emotions, and that goes against some of the worst types of prejudice and discrimination in history. After all, Aristotle wrote that women had fewer teeth than men. Obviously, not
he
much.
Used them to bite.
Well, not much empirical research there had gone on in Aristotle's day. So one of the things, one of the features, I think, of this Darwinian approach to human beings is to point out that Black people are not radically different from white people. Women are not radically different from men. There are no natural slaves or natural rulers. Underneath cultural differences, underneath linguistic differences, there are human universals which don't alter a great deal. But on the other hand, it is true, it seems to me, and I think this is also in Stephen's book, and in my book, Straw Dogs, to which you referred at the start, Sarah, the view of humans as fundamentally animals hardwired to behave in certain ways does deflate certain types of political hope, particularly the more radical types of utopian hope, which depend upon human beings behaving differently than they've ever done historically. And one of the things, one of the ways in which I think Stephen's approach is powerful is that it's consistent with the historical record in a way that other theories, the theories of Marx or Mill, other theories of liberal or radical or socialist humanism, are not. These other theories basically depend on viewing all of history up to date as a sort of mistake or a prelude to something completely different. I think we should learn from history instead of ignoring it.
Oliver James, I mean, part of your job is to deal with the on-the-groundness of humanity, with the problems it arrives to you with. How far do you buy Steven Pinker's version that we should put more into the innate, and that understanding of human nature would make the possibilities for progress more realistic?
I'm not particularly exercised about these sort of very broad questions of what is innate in human beings as a whole. The point that I want to talk about is really the extent to which individual differences, the explanation of why siblings are so different from each other, that's my subject. And on that subject, I beg to differ very considerably with Stephen, both in terms of his last book and this book, in that I, first of all, have a quite different reading of what identical twins and studies of adoptees tell us. I believe they show that, apart from a few very extreme and extremely rare mental illnesses and the intelligence quotient, which is a general characteristic, but apart from those things, the evidence does not support what he says, which is that half of that 50% of the difference between two siblings is explained by genes. This is simply not true in the vast majority of characteristics. And indeed, it's not just the commonest problems that we have to deal with in our society, like minor depression, anxiety. And indeed an awful lot of criminality, they're really, in the case of minor depression and anxiety, very minor, the role of genes according to identical twins. What does matter, however, and this is a huge body of evidence that is very rarely discussed and completely contrary to what Stephen says, actually, is not the status quo and is not based on a blank slate model either. What it shows is that the first 6 years are very significant. The way you are cared for during the first 6 years has a very significant effect on what kind of adult you are, and it has a very significant effect on, indeed, on what your brain chemistry is and what the kind of brain waves you have. This has been very clearly proven, that the brain waves that you have and the kind of electrochemistry you have is a direct response to different kinds of care. For example, if you were sexually abused, if you're a woman and you were sexually abused, on average, you will have 5% less of the hippocampal part of your brain. Stephen might say, oh yes, but you might have been born with that, except that you were sexually abused, so that's the difference. And secondly, that the earlier you were sexually abused, the smaller your hippocampus is, and the less and the more sub-personalities you have.
Okay, I know Stephen will want to say something, and I'm going to bring him in a moment. Hilary Rose. Let me say, I found Stephen's book very intellectually stimulating. I wasn't sure I agreed with all of it, but I was incredibly glad to read it. Did it give you pleasure, or, given where you come from, did it raise your ire?
Well, I liked the first half of the book, which I found really very interesting and a great deal more better written and so on than the last book. But I had really a fundamental problem. It was the book jacket. I mean, it's called The Blank
Slate.
Now, I don't really know any blank slaters around anymore. There were a lot of them at various historical times. I mean, you know, pioneer Jean-Jacques Rousseau. But I would have thought sort of the last moment in sort of intellectual circles was sort of probably Skinner. And I can't really think that, you know, I can't sort of find, as I think around about the place, which is, so I see the book as sort of fundamentally a sort of quite entertainingly written and full of enjoyable inconsistencies. And I'm one of those people who enjoy inconsistencies. Like, I'm amused at the way at one place you attack people who want specificity and plasticity in the mind, and another place you praise them. I enjoy that sort of thing in a book. I think it's all the fun. But I really don't think blank slaters are around. And that is my fundamental problem with the book, that it's a critique of something which isn't held.
Right, so let's go into that one. And the idea is that you've set up an opposition in order to knock it down to make your own point.
Absolutely false. And I was extremely careful when I wrote that book to identify particular quotes of contemporary writers and scientists and practitioners and argue specifically against what they said, because I know that that would be the pat criticism. And I'll give you four examples. One of them, one with which I begin the book, is that there's an enormous body of research that claims to demonstrate effects of parenting, effects of the first 6 years or the first 3 years, of which Oliver James mentioned, by showing a correlation between something that parents do and some aspect of the way children turn out. That parents who spank their kids more have kids who are more violent in their turn. Now, it's possible that parenting causes the child's behavior. It's also possible that violent people have violent children for genetic reasons, on average, and that violent people are more likely to spank their kids. Now, there's an empirical question.
Both are possible. How do you therefore move to prove either one?
Well, there's two questions. One of them is how you prove it, but the other is, do people even entertain that possibility? The answer is no. Study after study comes to the conclusion, makes policy recommendations, gives advice to parents without even asking the question that you ask, namely, how do we know that it's parenting as opposed to genes? The possibility of that it genes could matter is simply taboo. And I've been to scientific conferences in which people will announce these correlations, say, well, that proves that parenting matters, and not even bring it up as a hypothesis.
Can I interrupt you? Now, what fascinates me, Stephen, is at this point, are you being disingenuous? Or is it that you just haven't read the studies? Or what is going on here? You must know, surely you know, that there have been innumerable studies of identical twins and studies of adoptees to see whether or not genes are a cause of individual difference in violence. Now, let me quote you one example. Sarnoff Mednick, a major, major figure in genetic research, he studied the 14,000 twins, 14,000 children who'd been adopted in Denmark since the war. He looked to see whether or not if the parent had a conviction for violent crime, whether or not, if the biological parent, whether or not the adopted child was more likely to get a conviction for violence. The answer is no, he wasn't. And again, look at the reviews, George Carey's review. There is absolutely no dispute about this. Look at Robert Plomin's, the world authority on the subject. There really isn't any dispute about this, Stephen, that those studies do not show any effect whatever of genes.
Now you interrupted me, and there are a small number of parenting studies done by...
I'm not talking about parenting studies, I'm talking about the...
Can we let him answer,
identical
please?
Twins, correct. Can we just get this absolutely clear, because I do get very annoyed about this. Can you tell me, Stephen, whether or not you have read the studies of identical twins examining and of adoptees such as Sarnoff Mednick's study...
I have read dozens of the studies and I've read...
Of the studies I was just talking about, identical twins and adoptees, have you read those studies? Okay, what do they show? What do they show?
Just a minute.
Can we just answer this question? Yes. It's the only thing I really...
Very briefly,
the consensus of behavioral geneticists is that there is a substantial heritable component to all aspects of behavior. Based on...
What do they show, Stephen? Answer the question.
No. They show that there are correlations between behavior of identical twins...
Name me one study of identical twins or adoptees which show any effect on genes on violence.
You're not going to win the argument by browbeating me.
Exactly.
Let me
but you're not answering the question. You haven't answered it four times now.
You have tried to shut me up every time I've tried to complete the argument, so let me complete it. First of all, in answer to Sarah's point...
You're not
going to
answer
that.
That's very interesting.
Well, it's interesting that you won't let me.
You're answering Sarah's point, not my point.
Can I come in that side?
No, you can't.
Let Stephen finish and then we'll move on. Stephen.
The vast majority of parenting studies don't do the elementary controls for genetics. Some do, which I discuss in detail in the book, including violent behavior. Now, there may be individual studies that fail to show it. There are also individual studies that do show it. The proper way to settle a question is to look at quantitative meta-analyses so that you can't just cherry-pick the studies that do or don't show a correlation. The most recent meta-analyses, which Oliver James doesn't cite, show that there is a heritable component to criminal behavior.
Wait
a minute. Oliver, I'm going to stop this because it is not getting us anywhere, and people at home to be swapping statistics are not going to get any sense of
the broader
question.
But he hasn't answered
in
the
which
question.
We
I
are
notice
looking.
He hasn't answered the
now,
question.
Let's ask a very simple question here, actually, which is, how far do all of you around this table believe that violence is innate in some shape or form to human nature? Very briefly. John Gray.
Clearly is. Yeah. I mean, violence is a propensity which is very clearly evident in our closest animal kin. It's evident throughout human history from what we know, scrap of prehistory. It recurs recurrently. So while one would never explain every violent episode by a single set of causes, it's clearly a very pronounced animal predisposition. Let me mention just briefly one anecdote. Someone who I think took an open mind to these issues was Bertrand Russell. He founded a school in the 1930s based on the blank slate theory, which he almost describes in those terms, the tabula rasa. And in that school, to begin with, he had no rules and no forms of discipline. If you read his autobiography and his writings on education, he says, after a few months, I had to introduce rules and punishments, because not only was there bullying, but some of the children were putting hat pins in each other's soup. And that's a pretty dangerous thing. So in other words, what he discovered was, in this liberal, enlightened, tolerant environment of the school, certain dangerous human behaviors connected with aggression, although aggression is a very nebulous concept, but connected with aggression, did appear. So I don't think there's any question about it. It's just a fact.
I must say, having met Russell, I wouldn't regard him as a natural child educator, but however, let that by. So I don't find the anecdote very convincing. But what I think here is that, of course, we have the capacity for all sorts of things, but I would argue that it's always context, 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 which determines under which of our various capacities are going to be manifested. I mean, if it is necessary to be violent as a really pathologically non-violent person, then I hope that I would be violent. And that seems to me that would be a hope in my case.
Does that mean you can imagine a world or a form of human life in which there was practically no violence as a realistic possibility? Because I'm trying to see the difference between us. Again, I don't want straw men.
No, it's not.
Can you imagine a world in which human beings show... Can you imagine a world so just, so enlightened, so rational, so free of discrimination and cruelty, that human beings would rarely ever show significant violence towards each other?
I have a lovely, rich imagination, and yes, I can.
It's called the upper middle classes. You know, there's very little violence, actually, physical violence between, at least in public. There may be on the part of husbands to wives, but certainly.
I want to move this debate back to Stephen's book, and I want to move it also to timing, because it seems to me that there's a discussion here about what Stephen thinks he can and cannot say at a certain moment of time in our culture here going on here. You do a very convincing job in the book, Stephen, of looking at this moment in history where, in terms of technology and progress, this ought to have been a great century that we've come through, and in fact it's been a total disaster. And that both ideologies, in a sense, have led to that, both an ideology of innate difference, which is a sigh away from National Socialism, and an ideology of a sort of blank slate, which leads you to Mao in the year zero. And out of that has come a version which allows people like you quite rightly to come in and say, maybe we should talk about the limitations of human nature, because what we have just witnessed is a profound century of the limitations of human nature. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, underneath all this discussion, how much we anymore believe in progress.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is an area where I think John Gray and I, despite our agreements, probably would differ. I'm actually an optimist, despite my belief in a rather dark side of human nature, because I think human nature has many sides, and that there are explanations for the great social progress that we've observed. A simple example is constitutional democracy, which was explicitly based on a rather jaundiced view of human nature, that you shouldn't vest authority in charismatic leaders with a greater claim to moral authority than their predecessors, but set up a system of checks and balances so that one human's ambition will be countered by another. One person's self-deception will only be allowed to go so far because he's not handed the reins of power. The best summary was from the American theoretician James Madison, based on British predecessors, who said, if men were angels, no government would be necessary. If angels were to govern men, no controls on government would be necessary.
Okay. Oliver Jones, I want you to get over your ire here, which I can still see lurking behind. And I want to ask you a question sort of in a sense directly opposed to that, which is, as a good liberal, have you become to worry more about the possibility of process and of progress? And within that, is there a sense that human nature is less redeemable or less perfectible or less malleable than you once thought?
Well, I think that, for instance, in the case of violence, I totally agree with Anthony Stort that humans, as far as I can tell, are the cruelest species on Earth. And there's no doubt in my mind that all human beings have the potential to become violent. Whether you argue about whether that's an evolution, evolved thing or not, I frankly don't care. I think it's a fact. The reason I get very upset with Stephen simply refusing to acknowledge all the evidence that the reason I get very annoyed.
No, that's not true. You didn't let me finish.
Well, I'm afraid I asked you four times and you simply refused to accept it.
We'll agree there was a major disagreement.
Now,
carry on.
You didn't answer the question four times. But anyway, the answer I would give is that there is a tremendous amount of potential for... Now, one of the most extraordinary statistics is an amazing study that was finished in 1990. It was published in 1998 in this country, which showed that it was a very thorough study of 3,000 prisoners of their psychiatric status, psychiatric morbidity in the prison population. And it showed that 90%, 9 out of 10... convicted prisoners, are mentally ill. Now, I say to Stephen, the facts are very, very strong as to why these people are mentally ill. It is not that they had dodgy parents and that the mad are mad and the poor and the bad are bad because of their dodgy genes as a group, as a class, because most of the people in prison are poor, from poor classes. It is actually very clear what makes the difference. 40% of the prison population were in local authority care, and it is very clear that if you stay in local authority care, or indeed are given back to your biological parents, you have a completely different outcome than if you are given to a middle-class home. That is, it is absolutely clear that the quality of the care, the earlier you're given over for adoption, and the more middle-class and the nicer and cuddlier and more caring and sharing the parents, you get a middle-class child.
Although it has to be fair, Stephen Pinkley, one of the things you talk about quite a lot in your book is early periods of plasticity. I mean, you're not just a version of its just nature. In fact, you want to come out to play with environment. In a sense, more than environment wants to come out to play with you at this time.
No,
that's not true.
There are no doubt that there are massive effects of the environment. I mean, my own area of research, language, is such an example. Whether you speak English or Japanese is 100% caused by the environment. I think, though, that the widespread belief that the first 3 to 6 years are a crucial period of plasticity has not been demonstrated by neuroscientists. And this is something that neuroscientists now are universally saying. The Myth of the First 3 Years by John Brewer, who's one of the main funders of neuroscience research, shows that the hype has gotten way ahead of the science. It's based on a few studies with rats.
I do not want to go back into locked horns here, because I don't think it gets us anywhere in terms of listening. Yes, John Gray.
I think a small point of logic here, that it's entirely possible and consistent both to reject the blank slate view, as I do.
Well, we all do.
And to think that the first few years of any person's life are very important in that, in the subsequent psychological and emotional and other types of development of that person. In other words, logically speaking, there's absolutely no incompatibility between the two. And in fact, I tend myself to think both.
Well, in evolutionary terms, it makes perfect sense that the first 6 years you are plastic, because you've got to find a niche that's going to attract your parents' attention, because contrary to what Stephen says, and he doesn't even quote John Bowlby or attachment theory, which has 2,000 studies clearly showing that genes play almost no role whatever, and so do the twin studies, in the kind of relationships we form as adults. So it's absolutely
but
clear...
But there's an interesting point which we haven't touched yet, which is why, as it were, this is such an intensely emotive and ideological issue. If we were talking about the behavior of other animals, if we were talking about dolphins or gorillas, if we were asking what is it that determines this type of dolphin behavior or gorilla behavior, I do not believe we would be as intensely engaged as we are now. And I think the reason that we are is that it does touch on very fundamental hopes and beliefs and ideals that we've inherited partly from religion and partly from the Enlightenment and humanism. And some views seem to shrink those hopes or say that they're unrealistic. Other views seem to support them. I believe that the underlying diagnosis of why these debates have been so bitterly contested throughout much of the 20th century up to now is that it affects what we can reasonably hope for ourselves and the human species. That's the reason.
Stephen Pinkley.
The reason I don't cite all the studies on attachment, I should say, is that they're flawed. They're flawed. So let me... I think the fear of imperfectibility is one of the reasons that the debates are so emotional. There's the belief, which I think is unwarranted, that if you identify any feature of human nature, you must be a total cynic about the possibility for social improvement. Yeah. And I think there are avenues for social improvement. I just think they have to acknowledge human nature rather than try to rewrite it.
Can I put to you a problem that I had with your book, actually, which is about difference versus equality, and it's about feminism. I could argue that the empirical experiment of my life has taught me something that you, in a sense, as a sociobiologist, know, which is that men and women are different. There was a moment in my life when, as a feminist, I fought against that argument in order to get rights. If men and women are different, the problem is that that difference has expressed itself socially in millennium terms as oppression towards me. So it's been read by society as a reason to keep me down. Now, when I stood up and fought for my rights, I didn't see the likes of you guys on the barricades with me, because difference was easy to keep me in the home. Now, we're in the middle of an enlightened democracy, as you say, reasonably enlightened. At the moment, my rights are enshrined. But the danger with going to difference as opposed to arguing for equality is that take away some of that enlightenment, add on a kind of veneer of, I don't know, religious extremism or whatever, and you end up with me in Afghanistan in a burqa again.
No, are you
well,
exact
also,
opposite?
There's a slippery slope between Stephen's position and social Darwinism. And I want to make it quite clear, and there's a very interesting quote in his book where he quotes Trevor's introduction to Dawkins' tremendously influential The Selfish Gene. I want you to listen to it very carefully because I think it's much more revealing than I think Stephen realises. Darwinian social theory gives us a glimpse of an underlining symmetry, symmetry and logic in social relationships, when fully comprehended by ourselves, should revitalise our political understanding. Now, Darwin had nothing to say about social theory. He was a great biologist, and he wrote about ourselves as part of nature. Now, if you use the word Darwinian social theory, it gets incredibly close to social Darwinism.
Let me answer Sarah's question first, and then I'll answer Hillary's. I would argue the exact opposite, that if you base women's rights on the empirical hypothesis that men and women are indistinguishable, then you hold this very important principle hostage to the latest findings coming out of the lab. And in fact, by doing that, if it's shown beyond a reasonable doubt that men and women are different, you've conceded that discrimination
is okay. I'm not disagreeing.
Okay,
I'm just arguing that we spent thousands of years with this difference applicable, and it never led to rights before until we actually moved
that's
against
right.
it.
I think that's why the crucial guarantor of rights is the principle of fairness, that people be treated as individuals and not be prejudged by any group statistic.
And that's based on difference as opposed to equality.
That's based on fairness, and it's neutral to the question of empirical sameness versus empirical
differences. And individual
differences.
Not group differences.
And that's right. Individual differences are undeniable. Group differences, whether they exist or not, is a question that we can't decide from the armchair. We have to study it, but we've got to put the principle of political equality in a separate sphere from the empirical study of racial and sexual differences.
But immediately when you get into group difference, which is what you're getting into, you are not coping with the enormous variation within the group and the fact that, you know, playing out gender is so different across time, across countries,
I don't
across
understand
classes. Well, what I mean is it's a very old argument, which Stephen will know inside out, and that is the argument which the biologists who don't like this sort of stuff and the social statisticians who don't like it argue that you may see there are differences between men and women, but very rarely are these differences universal differences. Mm-hmm. And indeed, the whole essence of nearly every study, I mean, this is for me the enormous intellectual and, you know, scientific problem with evolutionary psychology, is that it takes the certainty that it finds in studies where of say insect life or birds or something. It takes that kind of certainty which biological discourse can produce. I mean, for example, to take the great Thornhill and Palmer book on rape.
Basic
argument that you can go from nature and looking at an animal, you can say in this situation all these animals will behave in this way. You cannot make any statement about human beings which follows that pattern.
John Gray, you think you can because your book is subtitled Humans or Other Animals.
Humans, Thoughts on Dogs, Thoughts on Humans and Other Animals. I certainly do. And I think underlying the nature-nurture debate are two different approaches to designing social and political institutions. One approach aims to have those institutions which, as it were, embody our best hopes for the species. A world without violence, a world without cruelty, a world without oppression, a world without discrimination. A different approach, which is the approach I adopt, and I think is not identical but somewhat similar to Stephen's, is the one which was exemplified by David Hume, the great Scottish skeptic. He said we should found government on a supposition we know to be false, namely that all human beings are scoundrels. In other words, rather than founding it on our hopes, we should found it on a shrewd, deep understanding tilted towards, as it were, skepticism of what human beings are capable. Put it slightly differently, we should found the institutions of society not on the best human passions, but on the strongest. And we should try and channel them in directions in which they can do the most good and the most harm. If we take that view, then we'll give up utopias, and I think we'll also, which is even more, and here Stephen might part company with me, we'll give up some of our hopes of progress. And I think underlying this emotive debate is really about nature and nurture. It's a quite different debate, which is the deep debate. It's the debate of what it is reasonable, and I insist on being reasonable, that word, not what our emotions tell us or our attitudes, what it's reasonable to expect of the human animal.
Can I ask one question here about the difference between animal and humanity here, actually, to clear John's point, which is the difference, it seems to me, is that animals would not be sitting around this table having this level of angry and passionate debate about their anxieties, hopes and dreams and fears.
Is that a sign of their inferiority?
Well, is that part of the evolutionary process? Actually, I want to ask a more simple question.
Or about
you know, is will we initially find a kind of innate gene which is a craving for social justice, which is a need to deal, which is a need for comfort, which is a need for progress? That is what defines our humanity as different.
The belief
from
in progress is very recent. It can't be.
It's very recent.
Yes, it's very recent. I agree with it. It's 18th century
sure.
onwards.
That's right.
But also, it's difficult in our present context to have a very strong belief in progress. And we're passing through an extremely hard time. And so, as it were, I understand your pessimism. But I don't, I mean, and I think, as it were, in other periods, you might have had a more optimistic reading. Because I would actually argue that our context does indeed flavour our outlook. So at the moment, I am not at all surprised to find rather biological determinist arguments capturing support because we are passing through a very grim period. And it's hard.
I'm not sure what correlation you have in mind, but the popularity of evolutionary psychology and behavioral genetics has coincided with a period in which crime rates have fallen, wealth has gone up, the environment has improved. The 90s were better than the 80s in terms of rates of crime, for example. So I don't see the correlations that you're alluding to.
I
getting back to Sarah's question.
Could you think on a world scale rather than quite so ethnocentric?
Yes, in a world scale.
Because that's not so good, the world picture.
Well, apartheid has disappeared. Fascist dictatorships in South America have vanished. The Marxist authoritarian dictatorships have collapsed. So in many regards, democracy has spread. So in many regards...
And famine and war you don't notice?
Famine and war have not increased in the last couple of years. There have been famines. The famines in the 1970s were much worse. Now, getting back to your question, what's special about humans? Humans are animals, and I agree with John Gray. We are unusual animals, not because we're angels. Many animals are unusual in one way or another. Elephants are the only living animals that have trunks, and that sets them apart from other animals. The equivalent of an elephant's
doesn't really
trunk.
Relate to my mind, though, their
no,
trunks.
But that's because, well, that's because you value your mind, and an elephant might value its trunk.
Well, my mind human keeps mind. Me in a state of anxiety about exactly these debates.
We have outsized brains, bigger than you'd expect for a primate our size, and what makes us zoologically unusual is that we've got these enormous brains with these huge frontal lobes that allow us to ask questions about the future, that allow us to try to burnish our social identities in terms of our expertise and claims to authority, which sets the stage for debate. So there are many things about humans that are just unusual in the animal kingdom and that can account for these obsessions.
But you haven't mentioned the most unusual thing about this. It's we're not the most violent primate. There are other violent primates that are more violent. The reason we're as dangerous to us, each other, and to other species as we are, is our prodigious technological inventiveness.
Right.
We have tools whereby we can multiply our numbers, change the face of the Earth, destroy other species and each other. Yeah. And it's that makes us globally dangerous, not the fact that we're inherently as violent as we are.
We're moving into the very end of the program, and I want to put another issue on the table, which is about this moment in our evolutionary development, because it seems to me that it is a rather extraordinary moment, because we now do have a certain ability to both understand our genetic makeup and to have some influence on it. That the technologies exactly that we've been developing have allowed us to address genetic change in ourselves. Now, take a long view back at that, and is that adaptation of humanity on an evolutionary scale, or is that humanity taking a control of its own evolution?
I'm skeptical that we're going to be able to re-engineer our genome in any significant way. Even though there's excellent reason to believe that the genome as a whole, all 30,000 or 50,000 or 70,000 genes have profound influences on us, any individual gene is going to have a very small effect. So I don't think that the majority of parents are going to have children conceived in a dish and genetically manipulated with all of the risks of health that we know are going to take place for a 1% chance of a higher IQ and some unknown chance of other side effects. So based on the fact that genetic manipulations are bound to be extraordinarily crude compared to the developmental program that turns a genome into a brain, I'm actually less worried than some pessimists or optimists, as the case may be.
Certainly, just to take even a single gene defect may have 400 variations. I mean, the people who talk about genetic manipulation at that level are just talking pie in the sky, and their shares are crashing seriously.
Well, we're also miles away from Oliver James. I mean, it's very doubtful indeed, in my view, that, I mean, we haven't discovered, apart from familial Alzheimer's and Huntington's chorea, there's not a single mental illness that's been shown to be genetic in terms of molecular genetics. I don't believe any will be. I'm very, very sceptical about this idea that we're going to be able to control them. But actually, the key thing is that evolutionary psychology, as Hilary said, has suddenly become very popular. The Selfish Gene was actually published in 1976. Yes. It didn't become popular until the 1980s. The reason it's so popular is because there's been a huge swing to the right, and it is a long-standing 1949 Pastore's book showed very clearly that right-wing thinking is strongly correlated with genetic determinism. Yes. And Charles Murray recently wrote the same in Prospect magazine. That's why we get worked up about it. So if you're gay, for instance, you're much more you're much more likely to be a homophobe if you believe that homosexuality is environmental.
But Oliver, whenever we get to this moment, Stephen gets tarred with a political brush that he's not exactly.
I wasn't saying anything about Stephen. Well, I was talking about evolutionary psychology.
Right. First of all, I think that's a just so story. Evolutionary psychology first came to the public attention in the 1990s, in which the shift in politics was towards the left. Tony Blair in England.
You call him left?
All right, we won't go there.
Compared to his predecessors and Bill Clinton in the United States, compared to George Bush Sr. So your correlation is backwards.
All right. I want to ask a question in a sense which looks at us moving forwards but almost moving backwards. When I think about your version of humanity, it reminds me slightly of sitting as a young Catholic girl in Sunday school when I was told that the truth about human nature was that it was really infinitely flawed and that there wasn't a lot I could necessarily do about it.
And this is the point, Sarah, is that evolutionary psychology never challenges the status quo.
All right.
Men have got to be men, women have got to be women, that's the poor nice. Are
Absolutely.
Poor because of their genes and so on.
It's a great moment. With 2 minutes to go there, Stephen, but I do wonder about that.
Evolutionary psychology is wonderfully plastic in terms of the political spin that is adopted by
Stephen, you've got the last minute and a half.
Right wing to left wing.
I believe that traditional notions that human nature has many sides, including a temptation towards sin, has received scientific support. You said infinitely sinful. Forget infinitely.
Well, it's more original sinful. It's more inbuilt into the mechanism of my humanity because of God and my, sinning against
God. But it's not the only thing that we're born with, and it certainly isn't because that we inherited the sinfulness of the original couple for disobeying God's word.
I think we've explained this debate to ourselves now. It's supposed to be a scientific debate. It was never about science. It was about politics. It was supposed to be a political debate. It's not about politics at all. It's about religion. It's about it's about the religion of humanism versus the truth of the human animal.
So we go back to your basic point, John Gray, which is that humanism, even the belief in humanity, is itself an illusion. And if we stripped ourselves of that illusion, we would be a healthier species.
Historically speaking, I think one can show that Enlightenment humanism, one can demonstrate that Enlightenment humanism was a mutation of Christianity and shared many of the myths and illusions of Christianity. Now, I'm not against myths and illusions, but I think the belief in progress is a shallow and not very useful one. I think we'd be better off with deeper and wiser myths which accept the ineradicable imperfection of human beings.
Well, all societies
we've got 30 seconds, very quickly.
All societies need creation myths. Evolutionary psychology is the one at the moment which supports the status quo in exactly the same way in anthropological societies. They tell stories about our ancestors came from this place, that place and the other, and that's why we're like we are.
Stephen, you've got 20 seconds.
Yes, it's simply not true that evolutionary psychology supports the status quo. There are many social reformers and left-wing social reformers who are active in evolutionary psychology. And the reason is that evolutionary psychology or any other scientific theory doesn't have direct political implications. At best, it can illuminate the trade-offs that we face in constructing policy. It can't dictate what those trade-offs are. It's natural that any illumination of how humans work can be taken into account in policy decisions, but can't dictate them.
Okay, Stephen Pinker, John Gray, Oliver James, Hilary Rose, thank you all very much. The book which kicked off that discussion is Stephen Pinker's The Blank Slate, which is published this week by Alan Lane. John Gray's own book, Straw Dogs, Thoughts on Humans and Other Animals, is from Granter. Oliver James's They Fuck You Up, How to Survive Family Life, is from Bloomsbury. And Hilary Rose last year edited a book of essays on this very topic called Alas, Poor Darwin, published by Vintage. Tomorrow night, Philip Dodd talks to Sam Mendes about Road to Perdition and A.S. Byatt about her new novel, and geneticist Steve Jones about masculinity. I wonder if he was listening.